You mean other companies?
No, that change by Woolard. I mean, you've described Fibres as being the self-contained department par excellence.
Well, when, of course, I wasn't around to see what happened, but it doesn't make any difference. You had to do it if we were going to survive, and this was part of the effort to make us much more competitive and to have our earnings in stock perform.
Can you talk about some of the particular individuals? You mentioned Buchanan, but other individuals in Fibres over time, are you?
Well, up to a degree, but let me just finish this up because I've...
Well,
and also it's getting about 12 o'clock. We can go to lunch and continue, but I'll take one or two more points here. We'll come to this at the end if you want to talk about individuals. Or my impression of those. The corporate DuPont company faith and support for Fibres could be depended on throughout my career. I mean, we got wonderful support, and for good reason that we had before. But that was important, and a lot of companies might not have had that. Now, here's something we touched on before, that is that Fibres personnel were outstanding in a broad sense. We had excellent hiring practices and human relations policies. There were clear objectives always, and everyone pulled together toward the same goals with no backbiting. Now, I don't know whether that same thing extended to the same degree through the rest of the company, but it sure did in Fibres. I mean, I felt so lucky so many times when I compared to what I was hearing in other companies and down through the trade. And through a policy of diversifying assignments, which we touched on before, there was an uncanny ability to choose outstanding leaders for all levels, including the CEO, and I mentioned Willard Cole and Holliday made it, and then the executive committee, we had Richard, Sinnes, Forney, Barnes, were all very successful. That's all enough what we've talked about a little before. Then there was leadership and some success in controlling imports. And the first significant increase in imports came in the 60s, actually. By the mid-70s, for us to compete at all, we had to drastically reduce costs. And this trend has never reversed. That's been with us ever since. And by 1980, there was agreement in Fibres, and I mentioned this before, that China would be our key competitor, and we had to try and reduce costs even more as close as possible to theirs. In addition, technically, we had to consistently come up with still lower cost methods of processing and still better new fiber variations to keep a reasonably profitable business. Otherwise, Fibres would have to phase out one way or another. And here, 22 years later, we're doing just that. And the last point I got here is, starting in the early 50s, Fibres had the courage and vision to tackle uncharted international waters with large manufacturing investments and expensive marketing organization to try and repeat our U.S. successes. And our investments grew from Canada and Europe to South America, Mexico, the Far East, and Australia. And today we've sort of shifted the emphasis from independent ventures to cooperative ventures, partnerships, technology sales, and so forth. That's the name of the game today, you know. Don't go off on your own in any part of the world.
When did that change begin?
I would say the early stages of it happened before I retired. I'd say in the late 70s, early 80s, but it's magnified greatly over, and then shift in philosophy to having your own plans and ventures in Australia or some other place.
How many?
Although, let me just say one thing: that when you were in an unusual part of the world, say, let's say Japan, and we went in with Lycra, we sensed immediately, because the culture was so different, the language and everything else, that we should have a joint venture. That was way back, probably in the 50s, some point, or early 60s. So the trend, in a broad sense, even started back that early. But it was for specific reasons. If it was in Europe or something, we wouldn't have particularly thought of it.
How many, just on the manufacturing side, I immediately think of Seaford here, but where else was manufacturing in the United States? How did that work over time?
See, I don't understand that question.
Where were the fibers made?
Well, we ended up with 11 fibers plants in the United States. I think we've gotten rid of 3 or 4 or something like that up to now, but they were chosen with great care what part of the country would go and where the labor would be the best, and so on. But we scattered. I don't know if you've ever heard an array of the.
How many were there in 1950?
Oh, in 1950, there were probably. About 5 out of the 11.
Mm-hmm. So it was in the 50s and 60s
they created an awful lot of them. Yeah.
And how many overseas independent manufacturing plants?
Well, they started as early as the 50s, but grew tremendously in the 60s and 70s.
I mean, how was manufacturing in Europe handled? Was there one plant or several plants?
Oh, no, several plants. It depended on the situation. We had them in Germany, we had them in Ireland, or the British colonies, the British empire. I know you should not empire.
Commonwealth.
Commonwealth, right. But we had them in Holland. And let's see, where else? Spain, eventually, we put some Italy.
So was bringing those on stream in any way part of your concerns or not?
Well, yes. And let's see where I would start. I guess back when I was involved in the apparel thing from a director marketing standpoint, we wanted to expand in Europe, and our customers, we, in some cases, we were pioneering, and we had to drag our customers along to get them. We needed somebody to depend on buying our product over there and doing what they knew had to be done to make it successful. Plotman was an outstanding example of that. We persuaded them to build a plant first in Italy, and then they built one in Great Britain. And Plotman, by this time, was part of Burlington Industries. There was quite a few customers. And then we became very close to people over there, like Marks and Spencer. I mean, we were very close to them. Mm-hmm.
You mentioned, just in passing, sort of international travel. When did you begin yourself traveling overseas, and how much of that did you do?
I did quite a bit when I think about it, but it started, I think, because of the first assignment. And I remember going in the early 50s, but this was connection when I had one of those industrial jobs we were expanding in Argentina. And I went to down to Buenos Aires to connect with a project we had on high tenacity rayon. That was my first exposure of traveling internationally. And then in the 60s, as we began to expand in Europe, whether I was in industrial or whether I was in the apparel side, I had to go over to the as a team. I was never leader or anything like that. I was just part of a team going over to look over a certain situation and see what, from a marketing standpoint. So we'd go with our, usually our general manager at the time. And I got involved, which is a story unto itself. I could almost write a book about it. In the early 70s, we were out of oil. In essence, we couldn't, our fibers plants were shut down to about 60% of capacity, which is dynamite, our earnings were. And our supply divisions in the pot, the petrochemicals department, so we couldn't get the stuff from Dow or from whoever. And that was because they did the oil shortage, and Dow had to take care of their plants and so on. And so we had to get oil. We that was the beginnings of a group saying we had to get in the oil business. But at that time, in the 70s, we had to do something fast. And out of the clear blue sky, we were approached by the Iranians that if we would build some fibrous plants for them over there, polyester, acrylic, and so on, they would supply us with oil. And so a deal was made with a partnership with individuals in Iran, but under the Shah. And that's a book in itself, but I went to Iran quite a few times, and there was the Shah left, that was the end of the name of the game, and we came out, fortunately, due to a lot of foresight by, we had in The Hague, in those early days, in the 70s, that if you were involved in a country like Iran, and there were others, in a venture, the bond company was, you advocated putting a certain amount of capital along with the people you're going into business with in The Hague, and that if the thing, for one reason or another, collapsed, an independent tribunal in The Hague would decide if anybody got any of this money that you put in. Well, we were quick on the draw here when the Shah lost control and all the revolutionaries took over to go to The Hague, and we got at least our out-of-pocket cost out, which was a major success. But that was a very costly venture in many ways, personnel-wise. But at the same time, we learned a lot. But it was really something. Those people are very impossible to deal with. One of the reasons is they've been taught, as we learned through one of our partners, French Wives, who dug out three books for us to read going back to 1000 AD and then another one around 1500 and another one in the 60s that had been translated, and they were all about family life in Iran. And you, if you were the good parent, the key thing you would do with both your own children, grandchildren, and so on, teach them never ever to tell the truth. The person that gets the blue ribbon is the one that can lie the most effectively. And if you think over generations, that's the name of the game. And then once we knew that, we were going crazy up to this point, that you're never going to get the truth. Then you've dealt with it. And they were, of course, accusing us of lying all the time. And they killed one of our heads of the engineering department, who was a Boy Scout, and they'd accuse him of lying, and God, he would turn purple, and his veins would swell up, and it, but they were, I don't want to go into that anymore, but what suggest we, it's after, well, we go to lunch and
let me just ask you if you would, to name, you name Buchanan, you name Bob Forney, just name me some names of other people who you would sort of say were important actors in the story of Fibers over time.
Well, I tell you, I almost, if I, we're going to discuss at lunch here, what steps next, if any, and I would like to research this a little, so I don't leave out anybody, because my memory isn't as sharp as it used to be, and there were a lot of people I could name, and I wouldn't want to miss
any.
Well,
you can add some to the transcript, of course. Just name me, to start the thing going, just name me anyone who's immediately to mind, and then hopefully in editing the transcript you can
add in. Well, I've alluded to some that, like Les Innes, now that I think of it, the man I would name first is a general manager we had who came several steps later than Buchanan, but Howard Swank, who I know when I was being trained in the Richmond plant, he was a process superintendent, and as I left my 3 months in that plant, if anybody said to me, they didn't, but who was the most outstanding person you met? Howard Swank. I had never seen anybody who was as sharp and knew answers to every question, dumb question I could ask, so clear, ask that he could answer in a clear, succinct way and accurately. And then I later, he observed his career, but he moved, considering his talent, relatively sort of slowly. He was not a pusher. But he did a lot of wonderful things for the company and for the department, and he was probably the best engineer you could ever find. He could literally take a piece of he could buy a house trailer or something, which he did at one point. Take the whole damn thing apart and put it together on first try, almost. And anything that went wrong with anything mechanical, I don't care whether it was your heater in your house or what it was, Howard could tackle it and be totally successful. I mean, he was just brilliant mechanically. He was a Purdue graduate, as Bob Forney was, and just fabulous. Bob Forney was outstanding in all the jobs he had. He moved into marketing and was moved around, and he did extremely well. Ed Woolard was phenomenal. Funny, Jack Kroll, who moved on up to behind Woolard, thinking about him and his early career, it's funny, I was involved when they were hiring, being considered to hire him, he had been in the Navy working for Admiral Rickover in the submarine business. And I remember I was approached by the personnel division and said, look, you had a little naval experience. Give us your advice on this. He said, we've been interviewing a man named Jack Kroll. And they told me he went to Tufts and then he went in the Navy early and he ended up in the submarine. They were working for Rickover. He wanted to get out, come to work for somebody. And they said, we have received this letter from Admiral Rickover saying don't hire him, that he's no good and this and that. And I said, this is easy. I said, this is the best recommendation you could ever receive. Whatever you do, don't lose this man, because this means he's probably the most valuable guy Rickover ever had.
Didn't want him to go.
And so he's poisoning any move. And I said, this is it. You hire him. Well, Jack was hired, and I've forgotten his first job, but he came into marketing fairly early, and we moved him around as we did everybody. But along the way, somebody said he's got to have more manufacturing experience. So they sent him to our old Hickory, Tennessee plant in a supervisory role down there. But in those days, there was a lot of excitement here in Wilmington. God knows, and he'd been probably 10 years with us at this point. Nobody would want to go down to Old Hickory in a job like this. But Jack saluted and said, aye, aye, sir, and he went. But I remember he'd been down there just about 3 years, and he was wondering, when the hell is he going to get back? You know, this was supposed to be part of your training in a broad sense. But I always think of Jack as being the best soldier and going through some of this at a time when it was, you had more options than you did when I was starting out. I mean, he didn't have to do this, but I can I think of some hot shot technical guys that were offered much less unattractive jobs than he was, who turned it down. And I thought, those guys haven't got it compared to Jack. They may be more brilliant than this and that, but by God, he's in there playing the game the way the company wants it and doing it right. And then we moved him around. He became one of the top people we ever had in the carpet business. Everybody just loved him. And I think he may have taken my place when I retired, shortly thereafter if he didn't. But in any event, every job we ever put him on, he did extremely well, and he was good with people. And I'll never forget, though, going back to one where the personnel people were scared to death on taking a chance with this top famous admiral saying no. That's one thing I learned from the Navy that paid off.
Yes. Okay. Very good. Well, thank you for that, Millard. Perhaps we should go to lunch.
Yeah.
Just say into the tape recorder, if you would, your home address here.
Well, my home address is 1430 Kennett Pike, Wilmington, Delaware, 19807. And the 1430 Kennett Pike is a place called the Country House. It's called a Methodist Country House, but they keep trying to drop the Methodist, because there are very few Methodists here. Yeah. But it's a continuing care retirement community. It's right across from the Wilmington Country Club. Very convenient in Wilmington.
Thank you.
All right.